Good evening. The second phone call is revealed, adding more fuel to the impeachment fire. The city council approves a controversial flood control plan. Next stop, a courtroom. And the churros bust. Subway's arrests spike as service declines. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Thursday, November 14th, 2019. Reportedly, a second U.S. embassy official in Kyiv overheard President Trump on the phone to his European Union ambassador about the need for Ukraine to pursue, quote, investigations into his political rivals. A source has been telling news organizations that a foreign service officer in Ukraine was at the restaurant in Kyiv from which Ambassador Gordon Sondland spoke to Trump on July 26th and overheard the key portion of the conversation. Here's WBAI's Jesse Lent with Impeachment Watch.
I'm Jesse Lent with WBAI's Impeachment Watch. Though Wednesday's public impeachment hearings in front of the House Intelligence Committee lasted over 5 hours, there was very little new information offered by George Kent, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in charge of Ukraine policy, or William Taylor, acting U.S. Ambassador in Ukraine, as both men had testified for the House impeachment probe before the hearings went public. Yet there was one piece of information that Ambassador Taylor admitted in his opening statement that he had left out of his deposition because it hadn't been brought to his attention yet. A phone call between Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, and President Trump that one of Taylor's staff members overheard during a diplomatic visit to Kyiv.
Last Friday, a member of my staff told me of events that occurred on July 26th. While Ambassador Volker and I visited the front, this member of my staff accompanied Ambassador Sondland. Ambassador Sondland met with Mr. Yermak. Following that meeting, in the presence of my staff, at a restaurant, Ambassador Sondland called President Trump and told him of his meetings in Kyiv. The member of my staff could hear President Trump on the phone asking Ambassador Sondland about the investigations. Ambassador Sondland told President Trump the Ukrainians were ready to move forward. Following the call with President Trump, the member of my staff asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland responded that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden, which Giuliani was pressing for.
The Giuliani that Ambassador Taylor is talking about there is, of course, Rudolph Giuliani, the former New York City mayor currently at the heart of the impeachment inquiry for his dominant role in what Taylor described as the highly irregular diplomatic channel set up by President Trump that appeared to circumvent the State Department's role in the region. But the staff member, who the Washington Post and others confirmed to be David Holmes, is not the only person to have been there for the call. According to the AP, Soraya Jayanti, a Foreign Service officer based in Kyiv, was also there. David Holmes is scheduled to testify behind closed doors for House members on Friday. Gordon Sondland will testify in a public hearing before the House Intelligence Committee on Wednesday. No word yet on if Soraya Jayanti will testify as well. For the WBAI Evening News, this has been Impeachment Watch. I'm Jesse Lent.
Thanks, Jesse. And listeners can tune in tomorrow, Friday at 9 a.m. for WBAI's live impeachment coverage. Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi held steadfast in her defense of Democrats' decision to protect their source.
When you talk about the whistleblower, you're coming into my wheelhouse. I have more experience and intelligence than anybody in the Congress, anybody's ever served. 25 years on the committee as top Democrat, ex officio, as speaker and leader. I was there when we wrote the whistleblower laws. The whistleblower is there to speak truth to power and have protection from doing that. And any retribution or harm coming to a whistleblower undermines our ability to hear truth about power. So I will defend the rights of the whistleblower vehemently.
But why should
vehemently.
Well,
the president can come. And if he has a case to make, does he want to come speak? Does he want to present in writing or speak to the committee about his what might be exculpatory for him? He has that right to do. But nobody, President is not above the law. President will be held accountable, and nobody should have the right to endanger whistleblowers. And that is the system that I will defend. And the American people understand that.
Mm-hmm. And there's many stories we could have done leading out of that about Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange. We'll leave that for future newscasts. And in related news, Trump is asking the Supreme Court to block a subpoena for his tax returns. It's a test of the president's ability to defy investigators. The filing sets the stage for a high court showdown over the tax returns Trump has refused to release, unlike every other modern-day president. The subpoena from Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. is seeking Trump's tax returns back to 2011 as part of a criminal investigation. A second similar case is headed to court over a House committee subpoena. And in world news, Palestinian militant group Islamic Jihad in Israel declared a halt to hostilities across the Gaza Strip border on Thursday, but a lasting ceasefire appeared tenuous as they differed on terms. Occasional rocket fire from Gaza broke the calm that ensued, but the ceasefire largely held as night fell. Gaza medical officials have put the total death toll from the 2 days of fighting at 34 Palestinians, almost half of them civilians, and including 8 children and 3 women. Hamas, Gaza's dominant faction, appeared to have stayed out of this round of fighting. They may have helped stem escalation. And Chile's finance minister predicted on Thursday that as many as 300,000 jobs could be lost because of the impact of 4 weeks of rioting on one of Latin America's strongest economies. The peso currency, which hit a historic low on Thursday, also raised the specter of a hike in fuel costs. Unrest began with a hike in public transit fares that brought thousands into the streets protesting persistent inequality in the South American nation. And closer to home.
Complete quickly. But we are going to have to clear out the chamber at this time. We are going to clear the chamber at this time. We apologize for all those.
The New York City Council voted to approve the $1.45 billion Eastside Coastal Resiliency Project, or ESCR, earlier today. The plan has the support of Eastside City Council members Carlina Rivera and Margaret Chin in the Manhattan Borough President's Office, but is opposed by the state officials who represent the area. The ESCR is also opposed by an ad hoc group of local residents. As the vote progressed, almost 100 opponents of the flood control plan erupted in jeers and were removed from the city council chambers. When the chambers were cleared, Rivera explained her vote.
Thank you. Quiet in the chamber. We'll turn it back over to public advocate Jemani Williams, and we will continue with Councilmember Carlina Rivera.
Okay. So this is the first project of many, and my colleagues, Councilmember Mark Traeger, and as you heard from Councilmember Menchaca Reynoso, and of course, Donovan Richards, we are always talking about how we can bring resiliency projects and more sustainable community development across the five boroughs, and I do hope that we can learn from this project, and it can be a model in many ways. I have to thank a lot of people very, very quickly, including Manhattan Borough President Gail Brewer, Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney, Nydia Velasquez, Assembly Members Harvey Epstein and Yuli Nu, State Senators Brad Hoyleman and Brian Kavanaugh, and all of our district leaders. I have to thank the community organizations that guided our negotiations. A special thanks to my community boards 3 and 6, and Susan Setzer, the district manager, and Megan Joy are here. Park users such as Solar One, our local sports teams, especially our Little League coaches, Tony, Danny, and Seth, the Lower East Side Ecology Center, our Stuytown tenants, and all the NYCHA residents at Baruch, Reese, Wald, Vladik, Compost 2, LES 2, LES 3, and Gompers Houses, all of the advocates and the community organizations that have provided needed expertise to this process, including Rebuild Design, Regional Plan Association, New York League of Conservation Voters, New Yorkers for Parks, the Lowy Sida Center, and Fab NYC. And I have to thank the Council Land Use Division, Chelsea Kelly, Arthur Ha, Raju Mann, Julie Lubin, Amy Levitan, and of course, Jason Goldman. And I have to thank my entire staff, but particularly my chief of staff, Pedro Carrillo, for shepherding this project through from day one. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak, and I proudly vote aye on these historic land use items.
East River Park and the FDR Drive that passes alongside the park was built in the 1930s by Park Commissioner Robert Moses, who was famous for bowling over community opposition to highway construction and other major capital projects like parks and beaches. His power came to a crashing end when Lower Manhattan community activists in the 1960s stopped his plan to build an expressway across the Lower East Side. After Hurricane Sandy in 2012 caused billions of dollars in damage, the city came up with a plan to involve community residents in developing a big flood control plan for the Lower East Side, part of what was called the Big U. The plan involved turning the park into a temporary wetland and building a wall along the FDR, but the city started ghosting or ignoring the activists in the spring of 2018. Then in October, they presented a new plan that would replace the community plan. The new plan would entail raising the 57-acre park with tons of fill that would be brought in by barge. The new plan would make the park unusable for at least 3 years and probably many more. It would force residents whose children use the park for a myriad of recreation purposes to find new locations. Mitigation is apparently non-existent in the city plan. The city plan also has no provisions for interim flood protection if a storm hits during the years of construction. Pat Arno, an activist opposed to the city's plan for the park, says she met with Councilman Rivera this week. Arno says the city is committed to their plan, and Rivera says residents shouldn't fear the city.
Each and everything that seemed like not a commitment, she said we should trust. And so that was painful because we thought she has a lot more faith than we do. We feel like past is prelude. She thinks that the city is going to do better. We could maybe move her on a couple small points. Our organization, as tough as our loss is here, I think that we will keep the city on its toes. We'll keep Carlina on her toes. If there's inches of difference between the plan now and what it was before, that I feel like we should take some.
But to the Sierra Club, which is opposing the city plan, trust is not enough. Lucy Cotin represents the environmental group.
This is an 82-acre project in a tidal wetland. The project involves significant disturbance in the East River. There are no details regarding mitigation measures. There are no details on landscape restoration. And we must ask, going forward, is this the way to confront sea level rise and storm surge? Is it going to mean the removal of coastal landscape and then raising every coastline? This is not a sustainable approach. Has there been a best practices around the world studied for coastal protection that has been shared with the community? This project will raise a great deal of dust. How will the dust from excavation be handled? What will be the impact on the substantial low-income and older populations? What is in the dust? How will the city monitor air quality, noise, and vibrations? What is the composition of the 8 to 10 feet of fill? They don't even call it soil. It's called fill. Where does it come from? What are the species of plants and animals that will be terminated, and what effect will this have on the surrounding ecosystem? What kind of disturbance and pollution will these diesel-fueled barge trips bring to the marine animals and the environment? What will be the effects from wind with the removal of close to 1,000 mature trees on the surrounding residents? The question of process and trust is considerable. The city has created substantial mistrust with the community through its actions. Why should anyone trust any agreement when they have experienced such a shameful violation of trust? The city has shown such disrespect for the community's time and efforts. The city boasts of 85 community meetings and extensive community engagement, and their response is to throw out the community agreement without any consultation with those participants, to announce a new design that no one signed off on. Now they want a partnership with stakeholders working through a CAG, a community advisory group, to advise on a plan that it fundamentally disagrees with, a plan for which they had no direct input. The question remains, who made the decision for the new design, and how was the new design formed? Who is the architect of this design?
And who can stop it?
Why aren't the records made available to the public of the meetings that took place behind closed doors? It is too late now for the city to speak of transparency when they have kept reports and studies hidden. And I here today speaking on behalf of Sierra Club. Thank you.
Thank you.
And besides East River Park and the FDR Drive are thousands of residents of public housing that live in projects facing the East River. Many saw storm waters from Sandy come far inland, destroying boilers and electrical systems in their buildings. The city has raised the specter of poor NYCHA residents being subsumed by the sea when another storm hits New York. But in fact, the federal government has already spent millions to protect public housing. Despite support for the plan by some, Baruch House's resident Yvette Mercedes sees the city plan as part of a bigger picture to evict poor residents and replace them with luxury waterside buildings.
I'm really upset. I mean, very upset. My name is Yvette Mercedes, and I live at Baruch Houses, and I'm really upset about this. However, I feel that this is just beginning. They have no idea what they're dealing with and who they're dealing with. And everything eventually will come to light. Everything will come to light. I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's being done, but everything comes to light. And I know that as a resident of NYCHA, I'm saying that I am going to fight as hard as I fought for this. I am going to fight so that Carlina and Margaret Chin and everyone who has betrayed us do not come into office in the next term. That's it. That's all I have.
Despite today's loss in the city council, activists say they're planning to sue the city to stop the plan or at least modify it. Their lawyer, well known to WBAI listeners and others, is labor lawyer Arthur Schwartz.
This morning I saw a tweet from City Council Speaker Corey Johnson, and it said, I know this is a really flawed plan, but it's something we have to do and it's finally going to move forward today. And I tweeted back, I said, not unless you beat us in court.
Yeah.
Schwartz says the city council vote is premature, that any plan involving closing a park needs state approval.
Assemblymember Harvey Epstein and State Senator Brad Hoyleman, whose districts cover a lot of this park, stated in public, and they put out statements that, in fact, this project should not move forward without legislation from the state legislature approving the alienation of public parkland. They were ignored. And they're going to vote, the city council is going to vote today without having sought the approval of the state legislature. That is improper. And perhaps they don't want to do that because they know that the state legislators from this district are opposed to the project.
Schwartz explained his legal strategy will hinge on legal precedent.
The common law public trust doctrine has long compelled municipalities in New York State to obtain the direct and specific approval of the state legislature before taking parkland for non-park use. For well over 100 years, the public trust doctrine has been applied to vindicate the right of the people of New York to preserve parkland for community use. This issue first got addressed by the New York State Court of Appeals in 1920, when the New York City Parks Commissioner was prohibited from entering into a 10-year lease with another public agency to build the City Park Arsenal Building. That case still remains a controlling precedent in New York. The court has explained, a park is a pleasure ground set apart for recreation of the public to promote its health and enjoyment. No objects, should be permitted to encroach upon it without legislative authority plainly conferred. 80 years later, in a case involving Van Cortlandt Park, the same court stated that precedent makes it clear that legislative approval is required when there is a substantial intrusion on parkland for non-park purposes, regardless of whether the parkland is ultimately to be restored. Furthermore, our law is well settled. Dedicated park areas in New York are impressed with a public trust for the benefit of the people of the state. Their use for other than park purposes, either for a period of years or permanently, requires a direct and specific approval of the state legislature. The case law is pretty clear. There are cases that say even 3 years is not temporary. And here we're talking about maybe 5 years and maybe more, where East River Park is going to be denied to the people who live in New York City for their use. It is unlawful for the city council. It will be unlawful for this project to move forward. We will be filing suit shortly to enjoin it from moving forward.
Construction is expected to begin next spring. Activists say they plan to go to court in about 3 weeks.
Vulture downtown. Just linger on the pathway where the river water flows. The lights will be bright there so everything grows. Downtown.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI, locally produced independent radio. I'm Paul DiRienzo. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio said Monday he supports NYPD officers who arrested a woman for selling churros, the sweet and crunchy delicacy from Mexico that tempts dieting New Yorkers as they rush from place to place in the subway system. The arrest was recorded and sparked a backlash against the cops.
What's going on? Why are you taking her shit away? Why are you taking her shit away? Y'all, she's crying. You're taking her shit away. She's crying. Can you just, like, let her keep her stuff?
No, ma'am. You can just,
why?
Can you just back up for right now?
What's she doing?
Danny Perlstein is a communications and policy director for the Riders Alliance. He says Governor Andrew Cuomo's subway crackdown is a cover-up for the system's real ills.
Governor Cuomo has determined to hire new police for the subway, even though the subway is extremely safe. And the MTA is facing a large budget deficit that threatens subway and bus service cuts. What New Yorkers need is more subway and bus service, not more police on the subway.
What led
to
the
last several weeks, there have been several incidents between police and New Yorkers on the subway. There was an incident where the police punched a teenager, another incident where they aimed several guns into a crowded subway car. And now, of late, they've arrested several low-income New Yorkers who are selling food underground.
Why have the law in the first place then?
Well, you know, the problem with flooding the subway with additional cops is that there's no serious crime in the subway to speak of. And so the result is that cops are going to focus on, you know, very minor behaviors that are different from just, you know, what regular commuters are doing. And they're going to criminalize primarily low-income New Yorkers and New Yorkers of color, which is exactly what we're seeing these last few weeks.
Is that like a return to the type of policing that Giuliani did and Bloomberg did, the quality of life policing?
One of Ryder's concerns is that instead of increasing service, the governor is scaring us, saying the subways are unsafe in a manner that's all too familiar from Rudy Giuliani.
What's the purpose of that?
The governor is manufacturing a crisis, but the fact is we don't need a manufacturer crisis. We have real crises in this city. We have a transit crisis where the transit system is terribly underfunded. We have a homelessness crisis of people sleeping in shelters, sleeping on the streets and in our subways. We need the governor to tackle the real crises that we have and not make up a fake one about crime.
What would you like to see done instead? What is the governor getting wrong that should be done?
The Citizens Budget Commission has said that next year these 500 cops will cost us $56 million. That's money that should be poured into better subway and bus service, not squandered on police officers who will criminalize New Yorkers.
Is there anything positive in anything that's happening right now, or what do you see is happening in the future?
In the spring, we want a historic plan to fund the subway, and the MTA has the largest capital plan ever to finally fix it. But if we're not running subway and buses frequently enough, New Yorkers can't get around, and our transit system overall falls apart. We need a governor to put New York riders first. Millions of us who depend on transit every single day, run more subways and buses, don't hire new cops.
So you think the governor is trying to distract people away from expensive solutions that he doesn't want to tackle?
We heard about fare evasion. We heard about homelessness. We've heard so many different things. But the fact is, we know what we have, which is we have a crisis of service on the subways. We need more subway and bus service. Money spent on cops should be spent on more subways and buses.
Danny Perlstein is communications and policy director for the Riders Alliance. In another incident between NYPD and subway entrepreneurs on Tuesday, police apprehended a 26-year-old black man later identified as Byron Shark for allegedly selling candy at the subway station. An NYPD spokesperson stated that the man was seen displaying candy for sale in violation of New York City transit rules of conduct. Onlookers captured video of the tense encounter. Police charged Shark, who did in fact have ID with him, with obstructing. Police charged Shark, who did in fact have ID with him, with obstructing governmental administration in violation of local law. His arraignment in Manhattan criminal court was pending Thursday. And that's some of the news for Thursday, November 14th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Jesse Lent. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson from the studios of the independent and locally produced WBAI News. I'm Paul DiRienzo.